The following talk was given at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on August 15, 2021. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Morning. Audio okay? Everybody can hear me? Okay. Thanks for coming today. Kind of occurred to me just before, as I was preparing, sitting downstairs, thinking about this talk today. This is a tumultuous time, you know, that we're living in. And it seems that everybody's doing their best, you know. And I know that that's a teaching that I hear often talked about at this center, is that we're all doing our best, and that's what practice is about. And I think that's a good reminder, you know, as I approach work, practice, daily life, you know, it's like everybody's doing their best with you know, the situation that we're in. And so I think that's just a good reminder. And I know personally, I've been going through a bit of, you know, personal difficulties myself with work, you know, home life, you know, just all the different aspects of life seem to have their own little issue in each one. And so, it's a good reminder as, you know, I show up in life that, you know, really all I can do is the best I can do. I literally cannot do better than that, you know? And so, if I hope to approach things with that attitude of like, I'm going to do my best and then, you know, the rest is kind of, you know, don't have to worry about it. So, anyway, maybe that's just a personal thing that I wanted to say out loud. But anyhow, the basis of my talk today is, again, the Shohaku Okamura book, Mountains and Water Sutra. I just really enjoy the book. You know, every time I open it up, it's full of, you know, just really important points that stand out to me. And so that's kind of the basis of where I'm going to go today is a chapter from that book. It's called Beyond Eliminating Thought. So one of the things that has come up in my thinking about practice, meditation practice, Zen practice, is the idea that if we could just eliminate thinking, the riddle would be solved, you know. And so this chapter just really, really stood out to me. So I'm going to read passages that are from the book, and then I have some commentary on each of the passages, and that's kind of how the thing is outlined. So if you hear what's a quote, it's by Shohaku Okamura, unless otherwise noted. So some people think that when we eliminate all thought and experience enlightenment, we are liberated. We don't have to do anything else and can be happy for the rest of our lives. I think this is a misunderstanding or even a superstition. Dogen tried to caution his students that the point is to let go of thoughts and just be as you are. No thinking is not enlightenment. That is not our goal. And contrary to what I originally thought approaching this practice, I think thinking really does get a bad rap in these teachings, and we talk about the relative world, and it's out. There's always a caveat, and for years I missed it. The caveat is that thinking is not bad, you know, like the relative world is not bad. That's it appears that way. That's how it appears, and it's not bad. And the point is not to eliminate thinking or the relative world. And so, I really thought eliminating thought was the path to enlightenment, you know, and if only I could just eliminate all thinking, I would be free of suffering. And the caveat with that is that I also thought that, enlightenment was to transcend the 83 problems. And I don't know if any of you, well, I'm sure most people have read Steve Hagen's first book, Buddhism Plain and Simple. There's a story in there about somebody who approached a teacher and said, you know, Can you help me out with these problems that I'm having? And the teacher's like, no, I can't help you. We all have 83 problems. You know, we're gonna lose people we love and care about. We're gonna, you know, have financial difficulties more than likely. We're gonna lose job. You know, it's just all of the life's suffer like problems. We all have these 83 problems. It's like an inherent part of living is to have these problems. But then there's an 84th problem, and that's that we don't want to have any problems. You know, and so the teacher points out that that's what he could help with is the 84th problem. And just like, you know, what I thought was enlightenment, I really did think that if I just could be enlightened, I would be done with everyday life. I could retire in a monastery somewhere. There'd be absolutely no suffering. I'd just be joyous, happy, and free all the time, every day. So I equated enlightenment with like never-ending bliss and happiness, you know. And so that hasn't been my experience, you know. And so in this practice, problems arise, you know, problems happen, and it's a part of life. And so enlightenment is not to eradicate the 83 problems, it's to really focus on that 84th problem, where we can do something about this. There's absolutely something we can do about this human situation that we're in, but it's not the usual approach. It's not solving all of life's 83 problems. Like, that's not where the freedom is found. And so I just wanted to point that out. So sometimes, and this is Shohaku Okamura, is sometimes I've had the experience of no thought, of simply being there. It was very pleasant, but from the beginning of my practice, I was taught that any condition is merely the scenery of Zazen. So I don't consider it special or a good part of Zazen. Sometimes my mind is very busy and distracted, but still, that is a part of my Zazen. So what he's pointing out is that even when his mind is really, really busy, that's a part of the meditation, you know. And so it seems like our natural inclination, or at least mine was, when I experienced a busy mind in meditation practice, was like, I'm not doing this right, you know. I shouldn't have a busy mind. Like, I'm not enlightened because I have a busy mind, you know, and I really had these thoughts. It seems like our basic function is to seek pleasure and avoid pain, you know. And so naturally, when I was having a really busy mind, a really obsessive mind, which I have an overly obsessive mind and I have since I was young, when that happened, it was like, that's bad. And this thought came up, which is just another thought on top of the thinking. But it's like I was seeking no thinking. And that in itself kind of perpetuated the issue that I was having to begin with. And so as human beings, I think it seems like it's a natural function to seek pleasure, avoid pain. And pleasure is, as pointed out in these teachings, is a form of dukkha. You know, and why? Why is pleasure a form of suffering? You know, that took a little while for me to figure that out. And it's because it doesn't last. You know, this pleasure, this happiness, it's not sustainable. You know, it's not realistic to think that we can be happy every minute of every day and that's sustainable. And so pleasure is a form of dukkha because things change. Our experience, or the experience, is that it's impermanent. Everything changes. So nothing stays the same from one moment to the next. And if I have this idea that I want to be happy every minute of every day, it's not really in accordance with actual reality, which is that things change. You know, feelings change. Material things change. Thoughts change. Everything changes. So nothing stays the same. And so, just watch leaning of mind. just like is pointed out when he was getting a busy mind in Zazen. That's part of the scenery of Zazen. There's nothing that needs to be done about it. It's just, that's what's showing up, and let it be. Just let the functioning of mind occur. And so watch when you're thinking, oh, this is good or this is bad. I shouldn't have a busy mind, or I should have a calm mind. Just watch that, notice that. And so as soon as you step into that equation with an intention for things to be a certain way, that's inherently suffering. And so even the distracted mind is reality. And so even when things are very chaotic, stressful, busy, that's reality. That is reality with a capital R. And so even when the mind is extremely chaotic and busy, when we're sitting on the cushion, that's just the scenery of the moment. And so there's no reason to get bothered by it. And so I think this is an important part of practice, is just noticing what's showing up, and that's it. There's nothing more to be done than that, contrary to our normal, the normal way that we do things. So he goes on, in our Zazen, we are like the blue sky. Many thoughts and emotions come and go, like the way clouds somehow appear, stay for a while and go away. We don't control clouds because it is neither possible nor necessary. Sometimes my mind is like a cloudy day. The entire sky is covered with clouds. Sometimes I have a beautiful day, fluffy clouds as in spring. Sometimes my mind is a completely clear blue sky. Depending on our internal or external condition, different scenery comes and goes. We don't control anything. Even when our mind is completely covered with clouds or we have a storm, the important point is that above the clouds and the sky is blue and the sun shines. And so even amidst chaos, and confusion, there's right beyond that is peace and freedom. The sky is blue, and so if we look at our thinking or the thoughts that come up as clouds that arise, right beyond that, at all times, even if it's a storm, in the midst of a storm, beyond that, the sky is blue. It's just that in that moment, maybe we can't see it, but it's there. And so there's a couple of stories I'm going to bring up today that you probably have heard before, so I apologize for the redundancy, but they're my favorite stories that I've, and they're about my experience here at Dharma Field. So there was a time, I'll just share from the beginning that from a young age, I've struggled with loneliness and feeling, separated or apart from the world. And this idea of a relationship or a partner or something like that has always, been the answer, the answer to the equation. Like if I only had the right partner or something, I would be lonely and I could be happy and live happily ever after, as they say, And so this is really an idea that I had from a young age. And so without going into too much detail, there was a certain point in my life where, I was always in a relationship from the time I was like 14 or 15 years old until the time I was like 25. And then when I was 26, a pretty significant event happened in my life that really changed everything for me. And so it was after that that I really started getting serious and focused about life. But at that point, it was like I was single. So it was like I was motivated, really engaged, and trying to do the right thing and head down a certain path. But it was new to me that I was really single, And so I didn't like it. I didn't like being single. And but nevertheless, I carried on and kept doing the things that I was striving to do, which was go to school and, maintain sobriety and some other things like that. And so I was very driven in that respect. But this other area of my life was just like not, the pieces weren't coming together. And so, again, that just, and it was always with me. Like, and I should say, even when I was younger, when I was in a relationship, I still had that feeling of loneliness, you know? So it was like this always overwhelming feeling of loneliness. And I just couldn't put my finger on it. I couldn't figure out why or whatever. And so anyhow, fast forward. I was sitting Rohatsu. I think it was my first Rohatsu at Dharma Field. And I don't know if your experience, probably a lot of you have had this, where it's like your first meditation. It's your first sesshin. And like how painful that is, or at least it was for me. And just like trying to get through, you know, it was just like the goal was just, I just want to get through this. Like this is daunting to sit for an entire weekend, with like no talking, sitting down, you know, and just like being in pain at times. Just very daunting to begin with. Well, I had kind of built my way up where it was like, all right, so 2 days is good, 3 days is good. Then I'm going for the Rohatsu, which is a 5-day sesshin. And I was actually Eno at the time, I think. And I went right before this. It was like a week, a couple days before. It was like right before the Rohatsu. I was dating somebody for a couple months, and she broke up with me. Like right before Rohatsu. And oh man, like that was rough. So I went into this Rohatsu and I was like, should I just cancel? Should I just pull out of this Rohatsu? Because it's going to be wild. To sit with my own mind for 5 days with those types of feelings was daunting to me. And I'm in recovery. I've shared that before. One of the one of the things in recovery is like, oftentimes people will turn to substances to deal with difficult emotions, whether they know that or not. That's kind of something that happens, is over time, the substance becomes the coping mechanism for dealing with life's difficulties, you know. And so take that stuff away, you're left with your own emotions to deal with, and that can be scary, you know. And so, I mean, I had plenty of sobriety at this point, but nevertheless, having that level of difficult emotions was very daunting to me. And so the natural inclination is to run away, you know, to I don't want to feel this. It's not okay to feel this way. And I want to get rid of that, those types of emotions. But going into this sesshin, it was like there's nowhere to go. I did it. I had a commitment. I was the Eno or whatever, and so I needed to show up and do this. And it turns out to be one of the best experiences I've had in session. I mean, don't get me wrong. It was tough. Like it was tough. And I'll admit to this, and I probably shouldn't, but I'm gonna admit to this. Like I was still hoping she would text me or something, you know. And so I snuck my phone into the bathroom and I was like checking to see if she had texted me or something like that. And she never did, you know. But that was painful. But at the same time, what I realized during that sesshin was that, emotions are not that scary. And in fact, like doing the opposite of what, I normally did, would do is to turn away from the emotion and push it away. It's like facing it, confronting it, sitting with it, and just seeing what that is was a powerful experience for me. Because what was it that I was afraid of? What was it that I was afraid of losing? What was it that I had to begin with? And so all of these kind of thoughts came up, and it was within the context of like wickedly obsessive thinking. What I noticed is that I was really mourning the loss of an idea. And so I had an idea of what my future was going to be like with this person. And so as it turns out, it wasn't actually the person that I was feeling so bad about losing. It was the idea of what the future could be like with this person. And so it was a really interesting practice to notice how much of my own thinking was a part of this suffering that was taking place. And then it brings up the next point of like, how can we ever really know somebody? How do we know another person. In a sense, it's impossible to know somebody else. And it's impossible because who are we? Who is I? What is I? What is the I that I'm imposing on another person that's constantly fluid, flux, change? So there's nothing at the core of what I'm referring to as another person that I can label as that's who that person is. And anything I can conjure up in my mind is an idea. An idea of who somebody is and who they are. And then on top of that, if I put myself in the picture and I picture us together and how happy we could be, it's all based in thinking, you know, and it's all based on my ideas about how things should be or could be or all of that. So that session was a powerful opportunity to look at suffering right, like directly. And so I walked away from that, I think, with a better understanding of where suffering originates. And so it was a really powerful experience for me. And that brings up the point of emotion regulation. As I mentioned, what time is it? 10:22. As I mentioned, the core of... So I work in the field of addiction and recovery. And so one of the core skills that I try to teach people is emotion regulation, which I have to admit I'm not so good at myself, but it's something that I, you know, try to do, and this practice really helps with that. But as I mentioned, one of the basis of addiction is running away from how we're feeling, running towards something that's going to make us feel better, you know. And with addiction, it's just more pronounced. This is a very natural and normal function, I think, of human beings, is we don't want to feel bad. I don't want to be in pain, you know. Perfectly normal and natural to have those ideas or have that inclination of mind, you know. It's just a part of being a human. One of the things that's helped me out a lot with emotion regulation was something that Steve Hagen pointed out in one of his talks. You know, and to my knowledge, Steve has never worked in the mental health field or anything, but it was pretty profound what he said, I think, and that's what is an emotion? And I'll bring this up in groups that I do. It's like, what is an emotion? And, you know, I've studied, you know, went to school for a while and studied social work, psychology, all that stuff, and it's really ambiguous. Like, what is an emotion? But as Steve pointed out in one of his talks, it's really a thought coupled with a physical sensation, you know. And what is it beyond that? Well, we all have emotions. If you've experienced really powerful emotions, you know that it seems to be more than that. It's all encompassing. It, you know, when the storm of emotions is upon you, it feels all encompassing, and it's a heavy feeling at times. But at the base of that, what is it? You know, and I, if somebody else has a better explanation or something, let me know. But as far as I can tell, that's really what it is: a thought coupled with a physical sensation. A thought meaning that we have an idea about something. With that idea comes sort of like this physical reaction almost to my framework of the world. And when that's pointed out, or at least when it was pointed out to me, it's like, well, what am I so afraid of then? Why do I feel the need to run away from emotions if that's what it is a thought coupled with a physical sensation? And I've looked at this within my own experience, and I can't see anything beyond that. So then why is it scary? Why is it scary to be lonely? Why is it scary to be feeling anyway, any certain way? You know, and there's nothing more to it than that appearance. And so just that small insight is super helpful to regulate emotions. It's like after a while it just became apparent that emotions are like the boogeyman. You know, there's nothing more to the emotions than face value, just what it is, you know. And so Suzuki reminds us that to give your sheep or cow a large, spacious meadow is the way to control him. And so again, this isn't about controlling how we're feeling, how we're thinking. It's just about seeing what's showing up and letting things arise and pass away as they naturally occur. There's nothing more to do than that. So if we think that this condition is favorable and that one is unfavorable, then we create samsara in our zazen. I want to get there. I want to experience this more often or longer. When we are successful, we are happy, and otherwise we are sad. Any condition of our mind is the scenery of our zazen, or the scenery of life. So we don't cling to any condition. So, circling back to, if you've heard that story before, I apologize. And I apologize for this next story. I'm going to quit apologizing at some point in my life. But it's not going to be today, apparently. So, as I mentioned, I've been lonely since I was young, up until the summer of 2013, and that's when I had a pretty important interaction with Norm. I came here for I was Doan, and I would sit regularly in the morning periods of meditation. And the summer of 2013, I was feeling particularly lonely. And I came in early, and I knew Norm usually watched videos on the computer or something before meditation period in the morning. And so I went in and had a brief conversation with him, and I went in and I was like, Norm, have you ever been lonely? and Norm was like, not since 1971. And I was like, my mind was blown. And I don't, like, Norm isn't going to be dishonest about this. So when he says he hasn't been lonely since 1971, I mean, that's really what he means, you know? And so I was like, flabbergasted. Like, whoa, what do you mean you haven't been lonely since 1971? And we moved on. The conversation was, moved on to what I was kind of experiencing. I was like, Norm, I experience loneliness all the time. It plagues me, you know, and I just can't seem to get rid of this feeling. And I kind of explained my situation, like, yeah, I'm single. I don't want to be single. And he's like, well, it seems very normal for you to feel lonely if you're, you know, 30 years old or whatever, and you want a partner and you don't have one. And so just that statement by itself was profound to me, because it's like I had this sense that it wasn't okay to be lonely. And just that in itself is a level of suffering that's unnecessary. So I started to realize that actually it's okay to be lonely. You know, like, what is the problem with being lonely? You know, it's a emotion, natural emotion that arises, I suppose. If you don't have a relationship or whatever and you want to be in one. So just that normalizing of what I was experiencing in itself was enough to dramatically reduce the amount of suffering that I was experiencing with that emotion. And then the next thing that he pointed out, I think was even more profound. And he said, it was within the context of this conversation. And I was like, well, you know, I am not in a relationship, but I want to be in one. And he was like, yeah, being in a relationship is good, you know? And then I went on to say, yeah, I wish, or something to this effect, like, I wish I could just be okay with being single. And he's like, yeah, being single is great too. You know, and it was like both of those things are ideas, first of all, that I was having in my mind of like being single, being in a relationship. And what he pointed out is that they're of equal value. You know, like, being single is perfect. You know, being in a relationship is perfect. It's just things as they are. And that being pointed out to me was just absolutely profound. I didn't get this realization as soon as he said this. It took me several days to reflect on this. But when I finally understood like what he was pointed out, I can honestly say like I have not been lonely since the summer of 2013. So thank you, Norm. this reminds me of rearranging the furniture. So this is what we do in human life, is if we can only arrange things, the world, so that we can be happy. Like that's all of human life, is like just arranging things around in a certain way, so that we can be happy and content and satisfied. But that's all it is like rearranging furniture within the same place. So, and this brings us to totality, reality, with a capital R. Is like, regardless of what we do, this is all it is. It's just this. So, no amount of effort or certain, you know, degrees or whatever you want to do, no amount of that thing is going to change that this is what it is. It's just this. It's always just this. And so, when I was thinking about that, that really came to my mind. So it goes on. I learned from my teacher that any condition, whether mental or physical, is just a condition. In my practice, the most important thing is to keep the upright posture, breathe deeply from my abdomen, keep my eyes open, and let go of whatever comes up from consciousness. And originally he put my consciousness. However, it implies an I, you know, that has consciousness. And so it's a common way we use language, is like my consciousness. I just let whatever comes up from my consciousness arise. But what we can notice about that is the I, the my, in my consciousness is in fact an idea. And so there's no reason to put my consciousness. Consciousness is like a part of the experience. But there's no like thinker behind the thought, and there's no I that does the thinking. And so it's just consciousness as it arises. So our practice is to just watch our minds. Watch your mind as things come up and pass away. There was no good segue. There's a couple different segues that I wish were better in this talk. I couldn't see any good way of doing this. But when I was developing this talk, and thinking and getting rid of thoughts, the three marks of existence came to mind. And the three marks of existence are impermanent, suffering, and not self. And so what I looked up is the three marks of existence are Buddhism's basic description of reality. These three simple truths, which characterize all things, are surprisingly transformative. And impermanence, this truth is the foundation of Buddhism. The Buddha said that all compounded phenomena disintegrate. All things are made of parts and all things fall apart. Another blunter way to put it is that everything dies. All of samsara is an attempt to deny this reality. The tie-in to thinking, and so this is the basis of this talk, is like no thinking is not the goal, you know. And so the tie-in is that thoughts are impermanent, even though it doesn't seem like they're impermanent. Like if you have the right idea of something, like that's the truth. You know, that's how things are. Maybe, you know, but not really. It's like small t truth, things are that way. Capital T truth, thinking, thoughts, concepts don't have, they can't capture reality. Like thinking just does not capture reality. And so thinking is impermanent. Our thoughts constantly change, evolve. And just from one second to the next, our thoughts change. And so they're impermanent. And then, as Nagarjuna points out, there are no things to be impermanent. And so when we think things are a certain way, It's an idea. It's a concept that we have, that we've frozen reality in a way. And we can't freeze reality. But there's no things from the beginning that could be impermanent. And so as soon as we put, like, freeze reality into a concept or something that's solid and real that exists over time, etc., that it just couldn't be that way from the beginning. That defies reality in a way. And so Nagarjuna points out that there's no things to be impermanent. So right from the beginning, there's no things. And this brings up there's no birth and no death. I'm just kind of disagreeing or changing this slightly of what I found online, is that it says all things are made of parts and all things fall apart. Another blunter way to put it is that everything dies. I think there's a deeper insight that can be pointed out here, and that's what Nagarjuna pointed out, is that right from the beginning, there's no thing that dies. There's no thing that comes into existence. And so right from the beginning, that's a confused view of how things actually are. So suffering. Every experience is marked by some quality of suffering, whether it's extreme pain or background sense of unease. As long as we struggle to maintain a solid sense of self, our lives will be marked by stress and fear. Our struggle will always be unsuccessful because of impermanence. And so, with every thing that we think is true and real, it's suffering. So as soon as we buy into something being a certain way or a thing existing separate and unto itself, there's an inherent suffering that arises with that. And so it's confusion right from the beginning. So what we do, and I've already brought this up before, is that we freeze reality into concepts, and then we believe that to be true and real. And so this is such a pervasive and sticky point of the human experience, is that we conceptualize. Consciousness is a part of this experience, and consciousness, as it's described here, is basically dividing reality into this and that, and one thing set against something else, and so it's a sense of things being separate. It's seeing separation. But right from the beginning, the separation is not inherently real, you know. And so it's real in a sense. We can't overlook that, but it's not the whole picture. And so with our doing this, there's an inherent suffering that comes up. And then the last mark of existence is not self. There is no solid, separate, single self. We have no core. We are simply the product of multiple causes and conditions. Impermanence describes how things are. Not self describes what they are not. Or, as Thich Nhat Hanh puts it, impermanence is emptiness in terms of time. Non-self is emptiness in terms of space. Kind of like that. I'll say that again. Or as Thich Nhat Hanh puts it, impermanence is emptiness in terms of time, and not self is emptiness in terms of space. So bringing it back to thinking, you know, and this notion that thinking is like getting rid of thoughts is the goal here. Thoughts are not self. And so, as I've already pointed out, as soon as we package the experience into an idea or a concept, that's off the mark. But it happens so automatically that's just a product of our thinking. And so every time we put like a concept to something, it's like we apply a self. There's like a self that exists. So a blade of grass, for example. As soon as we have the idea, blade of grass, and we see it as separate and distinct from the rest of totality, we've given it a self. And so this doesn't just mean like human beings, like I have a sense of self, you have a sense of self. It's not just that. It's also the separation that we see within things, material things out there. So the goal is not to not think. And so above the clouds, the sky is always blue. So enlightenment is seeing delusion. And delusion, in the common use of the term, is an idiosyncratic belief that is contradicted by what is generally accepted as reality. So generally accepted as reality. So we can have the right idea, the socially acceptable idea of what something is or how reality is. And if we go against that, if our beliefs or ideas don't coincide with a generally accepted view, it's delusion. It's considered delusion. And this gets into like the clinical criteria of delusion, etc. But for the sake of practice and from a Buddhist perspective, and this is in Steve's book with the glossary, delusion is the belief in the substantiality of concepts, i.e. manifestations of mind. And so this ties it back to our inherent kind of suffering, is that we conceive of the world as being a certain way. We have a certain views of how things are. And we believe those concepts or ideas to be ultimately true. So my name is Bo. I was born in Virginia, Minnesota in 1981. Blah, blah, blah. You know, I have a whole story that I can present to you guys about who I am. But does that actually explain who I am? Does that hit the mark of what I am? No. Those are all ideas, concepts of who I am. You know, and so they're stories that aren't ultimately true. Like, yeah, relatively, that stuff is absolutely true. You know, but ultimately, it breaks down. It's not ultimately true. And so this is the situation that we're in, is we live in the relative world. This is where we awaken, you know. But ultimately, it's not capturing what's actually what reality is with a capital R. And so there's no concept, equation, etc. that can capture reality, because reality doesn't need to be captured. We are reality. This is reality with a capital R. But as soon as we think about it, as soon as we put reality into a concept, we're off the mark. But not necessarily. If we can see that the way that we are conceiving reality, if we can see that mistake that we fall into, that we believe it to be true and real, like that's what we're talking about here. And it's a small shift. And it's really just not being deceived by what we're thinking. So it goes on. Sawaki Roshi quoted a dialogue between Zen master Longya Judun and a monk. The monk asked, "How did the ancient master finally cease doing things and completely settle down?" Longya replied, "It was like a thief slipping into a vacant house." Sawaki Roshi commented, a burglar breaks into an emptied house. He can't steal anything. There's no need to escape. Nobody chases him. It's nothing. Understand, it's nothing. The same works for you as well. If you want to obtain perfect calmness in your zazen, you should not be bothered by the various images you find in your mind. Let them come and let them go. Then they will be under control. So this is just the basic practice of meditation. Let things be as they are. Thoughts come, thoughts go. It's always just like this. And so it's just watching, noticing. There's nothing to be done about it. He says it's like a thief slipping into a vacant house. There's nothing to steal. There's nothing for a thief to do in an empty house, you know. And so as soon as, you know, the thief enters the house, it's like, what do I steal? What can I steal? And there's nothing to be done. just the intention kind of vanishes. It's like, all right, well, I might as well go eat a sandwich or something, you know. It's a, and that's just what it's like, is we're constantly showing up with some kind of intention about doing this or doing that. And it's like, what are we doing? You know, like notice, what is it that's driving our ambition? And just notice that it's always this. It's always just this. And so to attain perfect calmness in your zazen, and notice, this isn't saying it to attain perfect no thinking in your zazen. It says attain perfect calmness, because thoughts are going to arise. Thoughts are going to come, they're going to go. And so, but to get perfect calmness in your zazen, just don't be bothered by the various images that come up in your mind. No matter how powerful or real they seem, it's just an appearance showing up. So an important point is that thinking is baked into the cake. So we can't stop thinking from happening. The goal is not to blot out consciousness or something like this. It's impossible to do that, and it's absolutely not the goal of our practice. All right, so here's another poor segue that I just couldn't do it. Like I feel like things made sense up until this point, and then I had another idea of like what I wanted to talk about. And it seems related, but I couldn't figure out how to transition from point A to point B. You know what I mean? So I apologize for the abruptness. But thinking is baked into the cake. I've kind of said this before, is that we can't stop thinking from happening. It's a part of the experience. And so delusion is just believing the things that we think are true and real, with a capital R, which from the beginning it's... things aren't the way that we think they are. And so there's no thing behind appearances. So as soon as we believe things to be true and real the way that we conceive of them, it gives us a substantiality to the thought or the concept that really doesn't exist, or the way that we think that it does. And so as soon as we can see this, really understand what's being pointed out here, the substantiality sort of drops away. And so we can see that there's no substantiality behind the concepts, you know. And so this brings me to the final point that I wanted to make, and it was an interaction that I had with Steve Hagen, you know, and this was, I don't think I brought this up in talks before, but I had a pretty important moment, you know, in my practice here, and it was when I was still living in Duluth, and just the way that concept, you know, capital T truth, small T truth, like trying to find my way through these ideas that were being presented and the teachings as they were being presented. I was really trying to understand what is a concept, like what isn't a concept. And I actually sent Steve an email saying, like, what isn't a concept? It just occurred to me, like, wait, this is a like everything that I could look at or point to, it seemed to be a concept, you know. And so I had a genuine question, like, what is not a concept, you know? And the response was reality with a capital R, you know. And so, for me, that was a pretty important thing that was being pointed out, is that this is what we do. We overlay the experience with our thinking, with our concepts, and we go with what we think instead of what we know. And what do we know? Well, you can't say. It's just this. It's always just this. And so when I was, I came down here and I was still kind of struggling with this a little bit. And I had Dokus on with Steve. And I don't remember exactly the nature of the conversation, but towards the end, I remember this was like the last thing that was pointed out to me. And he went like this on the bench in the Dokusan room, and he said, "This is mind." And I was like, "What? Like, I was like, oh, okay. And I didn't say, I didn't understand at the time. And then I left and I'm like, what the heck did he mean by this is mind? Like, from my perspective, like, the material world, like the objective world, like, that isn't mind, you know? And like, that was a koan for me. It took me a long time to really understand what was being pointed out in that teaching, you know? And what was being pointed out, if I can articulate it, is that when we say mind, it's small m mind. We think my mind or your mind, or my mind, my thinking that is created in my brain, you know? And all of this, like, that's what I thought mind was, is like a personal mind that had a self behind it, an I that was the thinker. Like, that's what mind was to me at the time. And then over the years, hearing these teachings, it's like, oh, mind with a capital M. Mind as in reality. And this is juxtaposed with small m mind, where we think things are solid and real and exist unto themselves. And so, if we can see that this is capital M mind, it's that, like, there's no, and I do think mind is a good way to put this, that it doesn't have a solid, separate existence as we really think that it does. And so there's no thing behind this appearance. Like, this is an appearance. It appears this way. It shows up this way. However, does this table actually exist apart, separate and distinct from the rest of totality? No, but it appears that way. It shows up that way. And so there seems to be a step between seeing thoughts that are not real with a capital R and seeing reality, like material, the material world. Like, this also is mind with a capital M. This is reality. And so even that, which is not separate and distinct from anything else, is mind, is a part of reality in the experience. You know, I feel like I didn't do that justice, but hopefully you got some kind of sense of what was being pointed out. So I just want to end with a little bit of gratitude, so I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this, but thank you for being here. Thank you for the teachings that are here. And so I just really have a deep sense of gratitude for the ability to practice with all of you and give this talk today. So is there any questions? I know we have 6 minutes. Yeah, so it was Shohaku Okamura, Mountains and Waters Sutra. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.